Hello and welcome to Spieling the Beans with me, Dom Stevens, the storytelling podcast in which storytellers tell stories about telling stories. My guest today is a brilliant and critically acclaimed comedian, writer, podcaster, and producer. In 2011, after only 15 months of doing stand-up, she was a finalist at the renowned annual Funny Women competition and has continued to blaze a trail from there. That same year, she performed her debut show, Please Hold, You're Being Transferred, to a UK-based Asian representative, which was featured on BBC Front Row. She followed this up in 2014 with her national tour of her show, I Am Not Malala. In 2018, she co-created the landmark BBC Sounds podcast series, No Country for Young Women, which she hosted alongside Monty Onanuga for its four seasons. The show had consistently high reviews for its whole run, enjoyed a truly global audience, and was highlighted by Apple themselves as one of their top picks the year it debuted. And she hasn't slowed down since. As you'll hear in a moment, in the days running up to the recording of this very episode, it was announced that she would be publishing her first memoir, and she had just been hired as the newest BBC comedy producer. We covered, among so many other things, how writing a memoir relates to writing stand-up, making BBC podcast history, and her inspirations ranging from the dark poetry of Bill Hicks to the interviewing style of Larry King. So, let's get straight into it. Please welcome my guest for this episode, Sadia Azmat. Well, Sadia, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Dom. Lovely to join you.
Well, lovely to have you here. And let's start with triple congratulations are in order. Firstly, you're the newest BBC audio producer for comedy entertainment for BBC Studios, which is hugely exciting to hear. It must be hugely exciting for you too.
Yes.
You've got a newly announced memoir coming out next year, which sounds fantastic. And thirdly, I think it deserves congratulations. So the title of your memoir, I think, is phenomenal. One of the best titles I've heard. For context for listeners, and so that they don't assume I'm being impertinent, I will simply read the blurb of the book, which is a conversation-starting memoir about being a sexually liberated, hijab-wearing Muslim woman. Sadia adds, "It hasn't always been easy admitting I'm a horny Muslim, and I can't wait to share all the details about how I've learnt to love everything about my experiences," and the title is Sex Bomb. Phenomenal concept. How are you approaching writing a memoir?
Thank you. You're very, very sweet. So, I mean, the title, it was one of those things that was a happy, it just fit, which was really exciting, because obviously the connotations of violence, you could say, with certain radicals, and then sure. Also the taboo. Sorry to explain the joke, but yeah, just
Totally, yes.
So how am I approaching writing it? Well, it's going well at this stage. If you had caught me a couple of months ago, I would be in a different state, but it's been a very, very good experience. I've been very fortunate to be able to have that creative line, especially when we've been, in a situation with the lockdown, etc. What shall I say? So firstly, I kind of met my editor on Twitter, which was nice. She's amazing, Katie Packer at Headline, and I highly recommend following her. She's very viral on social media. She's also just picked up the memoirs of Lil Kim, which is... Yeah, exactly. I was like beside myself. So it was very exciting. And so we met, and I wanted to talk to her about my comedy and the idea of the memoirs. And so it's just, I think writing is really rewriting. So the first couple of drafts, you could say, I was just throwing everything on a page, on a wall. And then you kind of sift through what you have. You're looking at the themes that you want to talk about, what fits better than things that don't fit, perhaps. And then obviously structure. Sometimes you need a bit of a break from it. I read a few other memoirs, which was useful. But yeah, just I guess I've been working on my voice through stand-up for a long time, so it's good that that's is feeding into it, and so, you know, you can really get a sense of my humor and tone in the writing.
Fantastic. And is that how do you approach writing the memoir, the same way you approach writing a stand-up set?
No and yes. Okay. Well, I think initially I was, but I've been able to get some notes back from kind of more experienced writers and from obviously my editor, and there's things where I suppose the memoirs is a little bit more personal, whereas, you know, you can be a bit more flippant and off the wall with stand-up. But, you know, there's a thread of seriousness or, you know, groundedness that's needed throughout the memoir. So it is funny, I would definitely say, but there are subtle differences because, you know, it has to be personal because it is a memoir. And while stand-up is personal, you know, you're still, it's a little bit more of a hyperbole.
Sure, absolutely. And you are the only comedian I'm aware of who got into comedy directly because of and not despite working in a call centre. how did that come about? Because you were working in, I believe, the Queen's Bank, Coutts, is that right?
Well done. Wow. Okay, so anybody listening, if you need a private detective, I recommend Dom, because that's very classified. So I don't know how you know that, but I'm very impressed. So well done.
Thank you.
And my shoe size is 8. And I'm joking. You probably know that. I shouldn't have said that. So basically, they had a stand-up show and I was really impressed by it. And so I spoke to my manager in my one-to-one. And he was like, what do you want to do in the call centre? And I was like, well, I want to be a comedian. So he kind of put me in touch with the editor of the Banks magazine, who kind of showed me a way into the industry. And so basically, I had my first gig, and that was it went well, which, you know, sometimes they don't and people keep trying. But I was very fortunate that it did go well. And then from there, I kind of kept on finding other gigs and slowly figured my way out in the comedy world.
Fantastic. It does seem incredibly important that the first one go well, because even if the second, third, fourth don't go so well, you've got that first hit, that first sort of idea that, oh, I can
taste.
Do this.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I've been looking online, and some people, they're of the view that, quote unquote, everyone dies on their ass on the first one. But I don't believe that at all. I think getting on the stage is a win in the first place, because you know, when I started, there was talk of how public speaking is like ranks really highly in the list of things that people are afraid of, next to death and moving house. So to actually even get on stage, I think that, you know, is a huge thing. And I always recommend it as an experience to non-comedians per se, because I think there is, you know, I mean, it's so character building, and I really feel that his enhance my communication skills, and it gives you confidence, and it allows you to take yourself less seriously.
Totally. I heard an interview talking about how by the time you met the comedian you met there, you were able to present them with reams of material that you'd written from a teenager.
Yes. So I must at this juncture, I must confess, it was at the time, it probably wasn't very good looking back, but I tried. And no, I loved writing. I loved, you know, when I was a teenager, I would stay up late and watch Chris Rock. And, you know, I love the things that was coming out of his mouth. You know, it was so salacious. And there was such an aspect of truth and realness to the way that he projected it, in his tone and his frustration. And it felt really, really honest to me in a way that as a young person, you know, you didn't always get from the adults around you. So I found that liberating and refreshing. And so, you know, sometimes I would kind of, I suppose, impersonate his style with the things that I would see around me, and kind of try my best to kind of make jokes out of them.
Mm-hmm. And do you write it all longhand as though it's prose and sort of to the word, a sort of like a Jerry Seinfeld approach where every word is specific, or is it sort of bullet points which you then elaborate on stage?
Oh, very, very good question, Dom.
You
know what? Both. I think at the beginning it was far more the former, which is word for word. But as I've, you know, kind of become a little bit more used to performing and comfortable and familiar and you know, having fun with it, then I was able to kind of have more kind of bullet points of like, this is the beginning, middle, end. So you know where you're starting, where you want to lead to, and then how it's going to end. But just so that it's a little bit freer. My preference, I suppose, if I had to be honest, would be word for word. But I think there's a lot of fun to be had from kind of straying from the kind of formalized structure as well.
Sure. Do you remember the first gig you saw, the first comedian?
Wow. In real life, not on TV, yeah?
Well, either.
Well, TV, I think it would have been somebody like Bill Hicks, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his half-hour special. I remember watching, that was a very early one that is probably up there, if not the first one. Yeah, so I think it was Bill Hicks, and I loved it so, so much. Like the way that, you know, he was very unique in that, more of a dark poet. So he was leaps and bounds ahead of the audience. And although he got huge laughs, he was playing it for a lot more. And I loved the way that he would kind of deconstruct so many social issues, and you know, his performance was magnificent. It was so immersed. It was so kind of, you know what they say, Dom. I know you already know, but like obviously for the listeners, that what I didn't realize when I started is that the words have less impact than the tone and physicality. And so I found his performance was very you know, a good example of that.
Totally. Yeah, and the sort of the spirit of the language almost supersedes the letter of it.
Yes.
That's a really good point. I not really considered that prior.
Oh, I've done a lot of improv courses, Dom, and they hammer it into you that, like, they, you know, it breaks your heart as a writer, because, you know, we kind of dote on every last, you know, comma, if you like. But, you know, you have to learn that actually the human mind wants to absorb things as easily palatable as possible. And so if your tone, if your enunciation, if your physicality, or whether that's eyes or eye, you know, your stare, your glance, your body movement, whatever you're doing, that goes into the human mind way more than all the kind of Shakespearean prose we could come up with.
Sure, yeah, and the whole thing about 90%+ of communication is non-verbal, which,
yes,
is
exactly.
It's hard when you're sort of approaching something like writing a play or a memoir, for that matter. It's how to cram an extra 90% into those words.
So one of the tricks that I've learned, for anybody out there who's wanting to embark on any type of book, is you know, white space in the book. So there's all these research that says that, you know, the less there is on the page, the easier that the eye follows it. So if it's really dense, kind of heavy paragraph, you can kind of see a trace where, you know, the concentration falls off. But if there's if it breaks, and if there's, like, you know, more white space on the page, that kind of is better. So, you know, we just don't want to take too much in, Dom.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's Rupi Kaur versus a medical textbook. Which one is sort of you absorb in a different way? Totally. Well, is that a sort of scoop as to the sort of the typographical?
That would be telling. But, well, there will be some white space for sure.
Okay. Cool. Fantastic. Well, we look forward to that. It seems an odd thing to we look forward to that lack of words. I didn't mean it in that way. But...
I know. I still have a word count, though, so, you know.
Okay. Just add more pages. Just keep the ratio.
Well, that's a good idea.
Your fantastic podcast, No Country for Young Women, ran for 4 seasons on BBC Sounds up until last year. What was your what was your sort of starting concept with that? How did that come about, and what was your sort of main sort of top line drive for that?
So I feel really, really fortunate to have been able to do that podcast. It was when BBC Sounds was like kind of launching, and they were obviously looking for a bunch of pitches. And so Eli, who's one of the commissioners, contacted my agent, Chris, and he asked if I had a pitch. I think he found me on iPlayer. I had a short called Things I'm Asked as a British Muslim. So that's where he found me. And I did have a pitch. I thought, well, basically, me and my co-host, Monty, she's a good friend of mine, and we would often have phone conversations that I found really entertaining, and we would talk about anything and everything. And we had very similar experiences. So we both worked at the call centre, and we have obviously British accents, but our names aren't British per se. So, you know, that would attract some very interesting mm-hmm. curiosities from callers. And so I just thought that we had a lot of similar experiences, and I thought that what I wanted to capture in a podcast was what it's like when you're British, but you don't sound British, or you don't always feel British. And so that's what we were trying to explore in No Country.
Mm. Oh, well, and you achieved that massively. And some phenomenal guests on there, Rose McGowan to Ainsley Harriott, which I think is the full spectrum of celebrity guests you can have
it
on a podcast.
Yeah, it was so we were very fortunate. If I'm frank, you know, we were given so much creative freedom, and it was so refreshing to have that, because I mean, it wasn't what I expected at all. I would have thought that we might have had to kind of fit a brief, but I think that's what's so wonderful about podcasts, and which is why one of the reasons why I love podcasts so much, because there is just a lot of freedom and space to make it your own. Mm-hmm. And that's quite fun for unconventional voices like mine to kind of come through, because, you know, it would be very different for radio, and radio is great. But, you know, you didn't have to put on a radio voice, for example, even though I have one from the call centre, you know, I was able to, you know, I've definitely know how to speak, but it was just fun to be able to be authentic and, you know, talk about something that means something to you, that resonates with people, you know, who don't often get an outlet to share those experiences. And it was really fascinating to have some of our guests on, like Aluna and Ashley Maddock-Way, mm-hmm. who are both Londoners who left London to go to the US and said that, you know, we couldn't talk about this in London. And that was really eye-opening for me. And I would say that, obviously, going into it, you know, obviously as a brown person, I was like, you know, oh, I know about race, but it was such an enriching experience to be able to listen to so many different stories. And actually I learned so much from that whole show. It was really brilliant.
It was really brilliant. And it also seems, because when you started out there, there weren't presenters like you talking about those kind of stuff, and it seems like in the years since, it has sort of been the pioneer of more proliferation and more examples of that, which is fantastic.
We were the first on.
Absolutely. Oh, totally. Totally. Well, do you I was going to say, do you feel like a sort of not so much a mother figure of it, but a sort of like a pioneer of that?
I mean, you know what, it was a privilege, it really was, and I have to say that there was a lot of people involved that supported us, and white people at that dorm, you know, like mm-hmm. we were incredibly supported, and it was scary because, you know, it was fun, but it was also unknown territory, so we knew what we was doing, but also didn't know mm-hmm. at some point, but we were able to work through that, and you know, I mean, it's really exciting to be able to see so many other takes on it now, and if it did inspire some of them, then that's great, and I really hope it reaches the audiences that we wanted it to, and it definitely did kind of attract a diverse and rich audience from around the world, which we never expected. So one of the first listener feedbacks we got was from a white lady who'd moved to China from Britain. And that was touching. We had people from Africa ring us, Dubai, So we were astounded by who it attracted, and it just goes to show that these conversations are really, really, you know, relatable.
Totally. And it does seem that with podcasts at the moment, or particularly in the last few years, similar to sort of how television was in the 50s, in as much as that it's a sort of unknown frontier, and it's you've got the freedom to go in a new direction, and audiences will find you, just because it hasn't, it's a perfect example of just because something hasn't been done prior does not mean that it's not needed or not wanted. And it seems like No Country for Young Women is a perfect encapsulation of that. It was also historic in other ways, because I heard one mention you gave in an interview, which was, it's the first ever BBC podcast, I believe this is correct, to say the word motherfucker. Is that right?
You know what? I was about to say that, and I'm so glad I didn't. It was delightful to hear you say that, Dom. For once, I can be the less... whatever word you want to say. No, but absolutely, that was the case, you know. I couldn't believe it, actually, because unless you hear the statistics, you take your MFs for granted, you know what I mean?
But sure.
When it's put down like that we were the you know, I really got an appreciation for the hard work at the back end of a production, because, you know, you can present and you can speak and you do stand up, etc. But then there was so much hard work that underpinned it all. You know, the people we probably had regular daily dialogue with compliance because of such reasons. But it did make me really appreciate that the whole machine and system of how it worked. But no, that was good as well. I think as a stand-up, it can sometimes swearing can, be overused as punctuation or used a lot. And I think one of the things that I really liked about the podcast is that it taught me a different skill to stand-up. So whilst I still wanted to bring funny, I had a different job to do. You know, I had to be a presenter, and I had to be an interviewer, and had to be, you know, a host as well. So, well, that's probably the same as presenter, but, you know, it made me flex different muscles in a way that I didn't anticipate, because, you know, as a stand-up, you think you're just a speaker and you can do a whole load of speaking gigs, but it made me really, really kind of respect what was involved. We also watched a lot of Larry King interviews, and he's obviously wonderful. It was really good to be able to do something different and to kind of influence the space accordingly. And I mean there's, as you say, there's so many now that are doing their thing, which is, you know, which is good. But yeah, you're right, it definitely wasn't at the time.
Well, it is also the first time I believe that word has been used on this podcast, so you have a double first.
Listen, man, it's one of the best words that there is, right?
Sure. Do you remember the context you used it in to get past compliance? Because presumably they've had like documentaries on Oedipus where it hasn't come up. So how did you manage to get the first?
I really have to listen back to it and come back to you on that. I'm really okay. Sorry. I mean, I use them too often to be able to distinguish between the first and, you know, the last, quite frankly. But we did kind of have to, you know, limit them at some point, which is fine as well.
Sure.
I think it was just that it was nice to be able to have them rather than to have a blanket no.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we had to ration them out towards the latter seasons, just so,
that retains their power when they are used.
Yes, exactly.
How did you, because you've done live recordings, you did live recordings of No Country as well as studio ones. Mm-hmm. How did you find that difference in terms of finding, because with studio recordings, you can edit around if you finding a narrative through it. You can sort of fix things in post in a way that you can't with a live recording. So how did you approach a live recording as opposed to a non-live studio one?
So with okay, so we did two different types of live recordings. We did one at the Edinburgh Fringe, and at that one, Monty and I both separately, obviously, did some stand up at the top. We were really lucky to do that one. I was really, really excited about that one because we managed to get a whole host of amazing names who we would normally probably not have had access to in the flesh, as it were, because they were just at the fringe. So we had Aditi Mittal from India. Mm-hmm. We had Michael Oduwale. We had loads, actually. We had Darren Harriet as well. Mm-hmm. So we got to kind of integrate stand-up with the podcast, which was really cool. And I thought a really good use of the fact that we was on location there. Then we did one at King's Place. And that was really fun, actually, because we did approach it subtly differently because we were able to have a bit more interaction with the audience, which obviously, you know, you just don't have in the way that you do it in a studio is that you kind of read their letters and read their emails and stuff like that. But it was nice to, there was a lot of energy in the room. Monty had a lot of her friends in, so there was a lot of love. And yeah, we just kind of had a little bit of banter, but it was a bit more breaking up the interviews with conversing with the live audience.
Mm-hmm. And to a tremendous effect. And I've heard you mentioned before that because of your media pass that you got from doing the show, you got to see 60 shows at the Fringe.
Look at you, Dom, on my day. You know, everything. Wow, I'm so impressed. And yes, I love comedy. I was really lucky, actually, because I didn't know anything about this media pass, to be honest with you, but we just got it. And I was able to just use it to, like, book gigs. And I love comedy so much that I just had no choice. And also, I performed a lot. Like, I actually performed, like, 5 times a day. So I went to see those shows in conjunction with, like, you know, performing quite a lot as well.
That's a huge amount. How did you fit 5 times a day?
They're all over the place, Dom. You know what the Fringe is like. You've got shows 24 hours a day. So highlights, there was a lot of good ones. I had a list somewhere. But yeah, it was just too many. I mean, you know, there was opportunity to, if you really wanted to, then, you know, you could. So I just made the most of it, really.
Totally. And yeah, I also didn't know about the media pass, but I'll be looking into that for Fringe 22. Are they easy to get? Can you hook me up?
Exactly. Well, listen, man, you've got my details now. So, that's true. You know, when the next Fringe happens.
Perfect.
You can be my plus one.
Oh, amazing. We'll do a joint live recording. Shortly after starting stand-up, about 15 months after doing your first gig, you were a finalist for, Funny Women, or
it was so there was a live show at Leicester Square Theatre. Mm-hmm. I think the audience is about 400 or something, and it was good. I was a finalist. It was really, you know, I think, you know, when you're starting out, you just don't know what you don't know.
Sure.
And so it's a great thing, but you just don't understand it enough. Because it's funny, because like in a normal job, 15 months is like, you know, everything and you're ready to move on. But like in comedy, it's really just the beginning, because if you compare how much work you're doing, which is, let's say, 5 minutes times 3 a week, 15 minutes a week, you know, you're a baby, you don't know nothing. 15 months in. So whilst it was great at the time, without context, you know, you know, you don't know what to make of it.
Mm-hmm. And and shortly after being a finalist there, you were featured on BBC Radio 4's Front Row, and then you note that a producer invited you to perform at Cape Town Festival. And I was interested to know how you found South African audiences as opposed to British audiences.
So I actually didn't end up going. So if you've looked that up. Yeah, sorry about that. But I was on Front Row. That was at the Edinburgh Fringe. And that was really cool. So I was lucky enough to get a nice little quote from Mark Lawson.
Oh, yeah.
Who was like one to watch, which, you know, you're one to watch for 10 years in this game.
Yeah. well, now that makes the careful wording of a producer invited me rather than I performed. I've now. when you inevitably do perform to South African audiences at some point in your career, come back and let us know what they were like.
I will.
You've spoken a lot about wearing a hijab in your in your comedy, and I don't want to spend too long on that because I know you must be asked it in every interview.
I don't mind, Dom. Whatever you want to ask, I'm. You've done your research, so you know. I feel like I owe you that much.
Oh well. Well, thank you. Well, all I wanted to—I only wanted to mention it for the sake that a couple of quotes that you've said in interviews before really stuck out, and I thought were really great. And I just—I don't even necessarily have a question attached to the end of this. I just wanted to mention these, which were one point you were asked about how progressive you thought Islam was, and you noted that something which I think can be applied across the board, which is progression is about who is doing the progressing. And so things are always progressing, but it depends on who is the one who is progressing societal values and norms. It feels like that is a question that should be asked rather than the sort of binary, is something progressive or not. It's who is the one who is progressing values, because I don't think that necessarily there is such a thing as status quo as much as people who are moving the ideas in a particular way. I don't know. That's not really necessarily well thought out, but it.
No, it is. It sounds really deep, and I can't believe I said that, Dom. But yeah, no, I totally understand what you're saying, and I think you're right as well. I think that's a good point.
Thank you for making it, And the other thing I just wanted to note, which was you mentioned that when Muslim women are viewed as a singularity without sort of intrinsic multitudes, that leaves no room for mistakes. And part of the problem is that we're spoken for or about, but not to. And what I thought was that the work you have done in your comedy over the past decade and in No Country for Young Women has helped change that and has helped create more a sort of a multitude of stories and narratives and angles which aren't reductive or singular. So
that's really kind, Dom. That really, really sweet. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you for doing that.
I'll tell you one funny thing. There was one time I was at a gig and the audience came up to me afterwards and it was like, is that headscarf part of your axe? So you do get some funny ones, but I think it's because I just love comedy, and so, you know, I love that it's able to bring people together in a way that sometimes a headscarf doesn't. So it's very interesting watching those two worlds collide sometimes.
Sure. We've touched on a bit in terms of Bill Hicks was the first comedian you saw. And I'm going to ask you about inspirational idols, but just before that, I remember you a few questions ago, you mentioned you watched a lot of Larry King interviews in preparation for No Country. Why Larry King? Why did he stick out?
Well, first of all, before him, we used to watch a lot of David Letterman, but then that stopped coming on ITV2, that's why.
Okay.
But I tell you what it was. I love Patrice O'Neill, the late, great Patrice O'Neill, and he was on ONA, which is Opie and Anthony, a US radio show, a lot. And they had an episode where they was talking about Larry King and his interviewing skills. And basically a woman, unfortunately, something bad happened to her when she got into a car. And she had groceries with her. I won't go into the details, just, you know, not to make it awkward for anybody. But she had like a grocery bag with her. And then like instead of Larry asking about if she was okay or whatever, he asked her what happened to the groceries. So Arthur was like, I mean, I already obviously knew Larry King before that, but I think, you know, he's obviously one of the greatest interviewers, and he's interviewed a lot of actors that I like, for example, Pacino. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you just catch him because you're watching an interview of someone you really like. So I think even the interesting thing with good interviewing and stand-up both is that there's the illusion that you're the person's friend. And I think that's where I got a lot from Larry King, is that when he was interviewing people, it was like very personable, and it felt like it wasn't very news presentery or I don't know, it was just it felt like they'd just known each other all their lives, which I think is what is really nice when two people are talking.
I totally agree, and that does seem to be the gold standard, is when you can
yes,
get past the sort of standard
formalities.
Yeah, and the sort of the media junket. Who do you play? How much fun was it to diddle the And then when you get into the trivial and then the deep, then jump between the two, I think that's a cool sentence. I've never heard the story about the grocery, the Larry King. I think that's fantastic.
But it's like really taking yourself out of yourself. And I guess it's like thinking about what the listener would be thinking, but really going there, right? So yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think obviously there are some great British interviewing, like Emily Maitlis lately has been killing it, killing the game. Totally. But I guess with my inspiration in stand-up coming mostly stateside, that I kind of just gravitated towards those types of presenters.
Yes. Fantastic. Well, my final question is one that I ask everyone, simply because I love seeing how people interpret it, which is, why do we need stories?
Because stories are like life, right? And I think there's so many ways to answer this, such a brilliant question, but what I would say is that often you can feel alone, but if somebody shared a story, it can often make you feel like you're not alone. And especially with sometimes the topics that you talk about in stand-up, people are like, I've felt like that. But they, you know, they didn't have that feeling before the story was told.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the reasons. But there's a plethora. What would life be without stories? You know, it's the way that we share and connect with one another and laugh. I just think everything is a bit of a story, isn't it? And we all have a story. Sometimes I don't think that we kind of realise that enough, that, you know, just because you don't see what somebody's going through, it doesn't mean that they're not going through something. And I think what's challenging with what we're seeing these days with a bit of these identity politics is that we're losing the subtlety and the nuances and the context. We're forgetting that we are fallible.
Yeah, totally. That's really lovely. Thank you so much for saying that. No Country for Young Women is still available on BBC Sounds. Sadia Azmat's memoir, Sex Bomb, will be released next year. Sadia, how can people find you? What is your Twitter?
So basically my Twitter and Instagram is at Sadia, Sadia underscore Azmats, Azmats. As a BBC producer now, I'm not sure how much I can tweet, but I will definitely try my best to push the boundaries if I possibly can. But, you know, I don't know. I haven't had that talk yet.
Sure. Well, Greg James gets away with a lot, and he's a pretty big face at the BBC, so why not?
Oh, okay, good. I will look at his page now and I'll see what...
Just only retweet his, and then you can never get in trouble. It's just like a shield. Sadia, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, and for your, you know, time and your research. It's very, very good. I'm very impressed.
Oh, thank you.